Earlier this month, a tornado of historic proportions hit western Wisconsin, killed one person, injured, at least 25. And in recent days, we've been learning more just how powerful that twister was. Larry Mueller here, talking with our weather guys now. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, great to have you back.
It's great to be here.
Also great to have John Martin back with us. He is a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. And John, good to see you.
Yeah, same here, Larry. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you both with us. You may have some questions about tornadoes or maybe about that Chetek tornado or maybe all the rain we've been having. And maybe you're curious about the summer forecast. Well, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Or you can always post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And we always look forward to the weather photos that we get posted on the Facebook page. So please, if you've got a cool cloud or other weather photo for us, post it up and we'll talk about it with our weather guys. And that tornado that went through Chetek, that was on the ground for a long, long time, wasn't it?
83
yeah,
minutes?
83 minutes, yeah.
80 right. miles? So
80 miles.
The longest track in the state's history, I think, isn't
yeah,
it?
I yeah, I think so, too, yeah.
Yep.
83 minutes and 80 miles.
No, 83 miles, right?
83 miles.
They were almost the same number. So
was it?
I might have it wrong.
So we're talking 60
yeah,
miles
60
an hour.
Miles an hour, the thing is moving. Yeah, so if you're on the front right edge of that tornado, you get 60 mile per hour winds just from that, just from the movement, in addition to the rotation around it. So it was really bad.
Oh, so is that the longest one?
I'm pretty sure it's the longest one in Wisconsin
that we've had.
Now, nationally, I'm not sure.
No, it's not close.
I wouldn't think so. There are other ones greater than 100 miles.
Tri-State tornado in St. Louis went through St. Louis but didn't start there. It was March 1925, I think. That one was on the ground for 300 miles.
300 miles.
And there are some from the April 74 outbreak that were on the ground for a good long time.
Yeah, those are the ones that I think I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Is there an easy way to, or not, to explain what happens what are the circumstances that lead to something like
Man.
That?
I just came from a PhD committee meeting or preliminary exam where one of our students is actually working on exactly this problem of tornado genesis. So it's a fresh, every new insight is a fresh insight on how these things work. So how does one even form is still a question. And then I guess there's a whole bunch of ancillary questions of how come some of them last for so long? What is it about those long-lived storms that allows them to have their longevity?
Yeah.
We know something about the broad characteristics of the environment within which they might form, but we don't really have very clear answers about why the individual funnels develop
and last that long or, go short or hop. You know, sometimes they go and then they lift and then they touch down again.
That's right.
It's interesting. My daughter and I were watching TV, and I was clicking around on the channels here. I think it's this last week, and there was the movie, I don't know, it was called Tornado or something. I don't
or
know.
Twister.
That was it, which I'm sure has nothing at all to do with
with reality, no.
With reality.
I remember I saw that on opening night. Was that in like 1996 or something? I forget when exactly it was, but we went with a bunch of people from the department, and one of them's our computer IT guy, who's also an atmospheric scientist, and he said to me in the lobby, he said, well, now I know what paleontologists felt like when they saw Jurassic Park. I thought that was a great way to sum it up.
Well, they were trying to get these little balls to go up in the tornado, and that was somehow going to explain everything about how a tornado works.
Well, now we use numerical models of incredible sophistication to be able to diagnose some of the very same things that those fictional devices were supposed to try to help us explain. So we do it for a lot less money and nobody gets hurt.
But we still don't know what really causes it.
I'd say that's true. After what I just saw at this meeting, I'm not an expert in this, but surrounded by those who are at this meeting, I would say that we don't really know yet.
But I think we're getting closer now that we're able to, you know, have simulations of them in the models.
Yeah.
You know, now you can start pulling things out and changing the environmental conditions a little bit, or changing how the precipitation forms or something, and do those kind of sensitivity studies.
But there's also been sort of a race to be able to say that your simulation actually drops a funnel to the ground in your model, and so there's been some tricks used to ensure that it does. It's not the same thing as saying you faked it out, you completely made it up, but you do some things that may or may not be happening in nature in your model to try and ensure that the vortex remains all the way down to the ground. So even there, we're not quite sure, but with no doubt we're making progress. Quite rapid progress, actually.
You know, the Chetek tornado, it was originally, I think it was an EF2, and then the National Weather Service upgraded it to an EF3. What's the, maybe you can talk about what that means, what that means.
I don't know what the stages correspond to, but the way that the scale is assessed is based on damage after the fact. So if they went from 2 to 3, there must have been evidence in structural damage or something else that made them say, you know, EF2 tornadoes don't lift, I don't know, farm equipment off the ground. That might be actually one of the characteristics. And if they saw things tipped over or actually moved from one location to another, can verify that, they would have said, that makes it an EF3. So it would be something like that.
So they would do it after the fact.
It's always after the fact.
Yeah, it always is. And that's something that didn't do in Twister either.
Yeah, right?
They looked and said, that's an EF5. And he goes, you have no idea
until
you go assess the damage.
Right. That's right. It's always post-fact.
My daughter was, you're supposed to be scared or whatever, but we were kind of laughing at the furniture or the farm implements and all of the semis and everything that were dropping right in front of the car as they were racing toward the tornado or trying to get away from it.
What a trash the movie too much, but the things that I find really funny are the hail. Look at the hailstones. They are not hailstones. They're like flat chips of ice.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just silly.
And then a couple of leather straps saved the protagonist from being pulled in the middle of the vortex. I don't know if leather was going to hang up.
Leather stripes to a
probably
pipe.
Not.
It was still kind of fun to watch.
Oh, yeah.
You got to have it right there. Jason, it's like Jurassic Park.
Jason and Madison. And we watched that, by the way, too, recently.
That's an amazing thing to watch.
Jason and Madison, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I had a question that kind of regards those models you were talking about. I'm wondering if observations of other planetary atmospheres have contributed to that at all. Recently, we've seen some images from the poles of Jupiter showing big hurricane clusters. Has any of that meant anything to you guys recently?
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it's I loved reading some of the captions and the stories about those new polar images of Jupiter. People who have been studying the Jovian atmosphere for their whole lives say, we don't even know where to begin understanding what we're seeing on these things. So imagine what that must be like to be a 35-year or so career scientist who understands the Jovian atmosphere. And by the way, of course, it is true that understanding aspects of such an atmosphere feed back into our understanding of our own. That's absolutely true. So it's one of the reasons why one might want to learn something about other atmospheres. But to be 30 years into your career and say, wow, I have no place to start on, I don't know where to begin understanding what we're seeing on these pictures, that must be a thrill. And that's the kind of thrill we get every day, because the weather is different every day.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Jason. Let's go to Glenn in Fox Lake next. Glenn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Last night, probably 7 o'clock, something like that, we had a double rainbow. And the north end of it looked like it was coming down about a block from my house. And then I saw on the weather at 10 o'clock, had a double rainbow over the city of Milwaukee. Was that the same rainbow or two different rainbows?
Timothy on Facebook said he saw a great double rainbow yesterday. I'm not sure where, but probably one of those two places, Glenn.
I'm gonna do a cop out here and say that it was a different rainbow. And the reason why I'm going to say it is because every rainbow is different.
Yeah.
So everybody has their own visualization of a rainbow. So even if you're standing next to somebody, you're seeing the light interact with different drops of rain that are on the horizon. So everybody has their own personal rainbow, right?
Yeah, that's right. And now, but I'll do a little, I'll pull back a little on the, it's not a cop-out, it's physically accurate.
Well,
it's remarkable. But I think the rain that came through probably at the time that would have spawned the rainbow was probably not different from the couple of isolated cells that came through Dane County. So I would guess that probably it was at least a rainbow from the same rain event. That might be the way to span the bridge here, because Steve's exactly right.
So when you see this little glow that's coming right down to the ground, is that the end of the rainbow, you think?
I guess it is.
Yeah, because it hits the ground. So if you were to be able to lift yourself up higher, that whole rainbow would go higher and get arced up higher in the sky. So theoretically, if you're in a plane, and I know I've seen this once, and the conditions are just right in terms of where the sun is and where it's raining and where you can look, you can see a circular rainbow.
That's cool. And that's not the, what's the other thing?
That's not a glory.
The glory, it's not a glory.
It's a real rainbow.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, I've only seen it once. And as I fumbled rapidly for my camera, by the time I got my camera out, we were not in the right location to see it anymore.
It's before cell phones, probably.
Before cell phones.
Now, that's what it was. Now you could get that without any trouble.
And no pot of gold.
No pot of gold.
Or at least he's not telling us.
Right.
and what's the glory? You talked about glory.
The glory is you can see this, again, usually from a plane, or most often from a plane. If you're flying over a deck of low-level clouds, uniform clouds, like a Stratus-type deck, and if you can see the shadow of the plane cast onto the cloud deck, then around there you'll see colored rings. And that's associated with how the light kind of gets trapped on the surface of the cloud droplets and generates a ring of colors, which is, again, really fascinating. But you have to be looking for it. You got to look down and be next to a window.
And
be on a plane.
Weather is just wonderful, isn't it?
It is. It is. 100%.
Thanks a lot, Glenn, for calling. Appreciate it. Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences are guests at UW. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Talking weather today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and my weather guy's back with us once again. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. Great to have them along. And Raleigh in Oak Creek has a question. Let's go there. Hi, thank you for calling. Well, we lost him, but he had a question about the solar eclipse. And
that is happening on August 21st, I think.
Yeah, something like
US.
That, yeah.
Go see it. That's the thing that I would say. I saw the one that passed through in 1979, and I'll tell you, you can see pictures and videos, but it is nothing like being there and experiencing the entire environmental change. I know we saw it up in, I think it was in North Dakota, and so it's flat, and a lot of where this is going to be going through is through Wyoming and areas of Nebraska, I guess, also where it's flat. And, man, you could see the Terminator, which is the shadow of the sun, come racing towards you, towards the field. And I know we're going to go to Wyoming. I shouldn't have said that because I don't want anybody else, because it's going to be crowded because Wyoming's planning for it. They're setting up viewing sites on the highway. If you don't have a hotel, good luck. They're over $1,000 a night now for a single night in Casper, Wyoming, which is, one of the cities that's going through.
I think they describe it as fabulous Casper, actually.
Yeah, you can go to Casper because I'm not going to Casper.
That's awesome.
But, yeah, if you got an opportunity to go do it, go see it. And I would highly recommend that you get an app on your smartphone that allows you to look at satellite imagery, because if it's cloudy, where you happen to be, the satellite imagery can help you figure out where to go. I know we did that in 1979, which was pretty rare to be able to do that
that far back,
because satellites were new, but it allowed us to see it. And, man, there's a couple of things you need to see in life. One is the Grand Canyon, and the other is a total eclipse. This is just mind-boggling.
We have, on a whole different matter, I think we've got Bill in Elm Grove with a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hi there, Larry. I want to tell you I love your show because you're so polite to everyone. So courteous.
Yeah, he's going to hang up on you.
I wish I were your neighbor. Anyway, I'm a retired Air Force pilot and a transoceanic airline pilot. Once a pilot training back in the mid-1950s, and this might be hard for you to believe, but I had a weatherman. He was not a pilot, but he said thunderstorms only went to about 18,000. Sears cards are up around 22,000. So this was obviously somebody who'd never flown in a jet.
Probably,
obviously.
So that's how much we've learned since then.
Yeah.
But other things, I heard once this story about before they really knew what jet streams were, the B-29s were coming back from Asia or Asia, and they had tailwinds of like 175 knots or something like that, and the guys couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And I do have one question. And why? I mean, I know this because, you know, I know something about a little bit about weather, having flown for 28,000 hours. But why does the United States have Tornado Alley? I know that like 90% of tornadoes happen in the United States or southern Canada, and very seldom happen other places.
Yeah.
Good question. Thanks for calling, Bill.
That's a really good question, and it's probably been as exciting tornado-wise on this continent as it is now for millions and millions of years. That there's a really interesting proximity of geographic features that feed into hurricanes. Tornadoes. Tornadoes form in severe thunderstorm environments that are fueled by the presence of really warm, moist air in the lowest part of the atmosphere, the one that touches the ground maybe a kilometer or so deep, and then dry, warm air in the middle levels. And if that kind of stratification can be lifted by the invasion of upper-level waves or some other kind of weather system, then you can get explosive development of thunderstorms. And so it just so happens that the Gulf of Mexico and the plateau of Mexico in the country of Mexico are in such close proximity in the southwestern part of North America that that's a regular occurrence from about May to about August over the central plains of North America. And there's no place else like it that comes close to the same degree of those intense, the warm, dry air in mid-levels and the warm, moist air at the ground. The southern Mediterranean, southwest Mediterranean may be another place where places in Spain and France can get tornadoes, but nothing quite like North America. And there it's the deserts of, you know, the northern part of the Sahara, the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, and the Mediterranean Sea. But there's no place else like home. It's ironic, but, but it is true. When you're talking about tornadoes, there's no place like it. And that's really the key thing right there.
No. You clicking your ruby slippers.
Yeah. There's no place like home.
Bill, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Ted a chance to join us from Toma. Ted, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I kind of have a two-part question. Going back to tornadoes, when you see, you know, aerial photos of the aftermath of some of this destruction, there can be whole towns that are just gone. Where does this stuff go? I mean, I know, does it just get pulverized or what? Or why isn't it raining down just all over this stuff? You know, I mean, it's...
So actually it does. Yeah. And there's a former student of ours, my co-author, John Knox, who him and his students did a study where they noticed that there was somebody on Facebook. This was a 2012 tornadoes.
Yeah.
That was another really active season. And an individual had found, you know, so they weren't hit by the tornado. They were, you know, miles away, hundreds of miles away. But they were finding things appear in their yard. And so she set up a Facebook site that, you know, that would post it. Here's a picture of it. If it's yours, let me know. And then a bunch of other people started to do that. And so, and then people were able to then claim it and give their address of where they lived. And then they would send it back to them. And so they were able to do this study of how far this material spread.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It was an amazing use of social media on both accounts. One, to help people reclaim pictures, for example, from families, and then to use that as a research thing to see where the debris went. And I can't remember how far it went, but I remember
states. 300 or so miles was one of the longer distances.
So it gets dispersed. It gets pulled up and then into the storm and then thrown out of the storm hundreds of miles away or just around the block.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask another question?
Sure.
What would be the largest thing that's ever been flown away? I mean, you know, like a locomotive engine or something go 100 miles? Or I mean, what's the largest thing known to have really been taken somewhere?
If I remember right, in the John Knox study from University of Georgia, I think they had a canceled check or some other thing with an address and a name on it that was on the order of the 300 miles distance. I can't remember what the... Certainly things like locomotives get lifted off the tracks, but probably just deposited in the gully next to the tracks. They don't go anywhere. They're too massive. But I wonder, too, you have a good question. What is the you know, let's say a 10-mile radius, what kind of object can disappear 10 miles away? People's bodies, as grisly as it is, can be found 10 or 15 or 20 miles away from where they were last seen before a disastrous tornado strike. So something as massive as a 100-kilogram person can be moved 20 miles. I do know that. But I don't know about
it
in between.
Interesting analysis I need to do. Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And speaking of the destructive nature of tornadoes, we have a couple of tornado aftermath photos on our Facebook page. If you want to see those, go to the Larry Mueller Show. And Daniel sent one that he said the photo is there's almost nothing there. And he said that was a field of heavy timber.
Mm. Wow.
And there's
virtually very few would know that now. It's like,
you certainly wouldn't know
it's like
that.
No man's land in France or something.
But those are the type of analysis they'll look to do the classification of an EF3.
Yeah, yeah.
And here's a photo from Paul sent a photo of the same night as the Chetek tornado. These are clouds taken, a photo of some clouds taken from, I guess, where he lives.
Yeah, those are Mamatas clouds. They're Mamatas? I don't know. you're from Boston. I'm from Long Island.
Oh, so I'll assume I say it right and you don't. That's probably safe.
I can remember seeing those clouds in northern Wisconsin one night on, just before dark, and they were really low, and they were really scary.
Yeah,
so those
awesome
kind of bulbs.
And they got underlit, you know, at the right time of day. They just stand out there. Just
and actually, dramatic. They were here... maybe within the last month, for sure, there were sightings of them in Madison, too. Okay. There wasn't any severe weather. But.
And back to tornadoes for a minute. Here's another really cool photo that Kyle sent of a rainbow that is really... Is it a double? No, it's a single.
It's a single rainbow, horizon to horizon, so that
horizon
complete
to
rainbow,
horizon,
which we don't see all that often.
But it does show the really other interesting aspect of, especially the single rainbow, that there's more light inside the arc than there is outside the arc.
Yeah.
And that you can see that dramatically on that picture. That's pretty
neat. Why is that? That's...
Because the light gets refracted and turned inward, isn't that right, or something?
Yeah,
like
no. I think the areas where it's dark, that's where the rainbow light would have gone. But instead of going into that darker region, it's going into the rainbow.
Yeah,
so it makes it look a little darker.
Okay. Very interesting. By the way, if you have a weather or climate question, join in. We've got open lines. Get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Bob and Eau Claire up next. Bob, hi.
Hey, good morning, guys. Or good afternoon. I'm sorry. And this has been a fascinating discussion. I'd like to go back just for a minute to the discussion about the solar eclipse. Steve, I completely agree with you. We got to see the last total eclipse in North America in February of 79. We went up to the western shore of Lake Winnipeg at a little town just outside of a little town called Gimli, and it's one of those things you never forget. We did see the Terminator coming kind of south from a southeasterly direction toward us, and as soon as that disc enveloped us, all of a sudden, it got eerily quiet, and birds were twittering. It was amazing, that experience. And I agree with you. It moves heaven and earth to go see that if you can.
Yeah.
I've been to the Grand Canyon. I agree with you. That is another bucket list item that you should also see. And I would add to that Yellowstone National Park. Yellowstone National Park is absolutely beyond any description if you don't see it firsthand. Yeah. And you can see a million pictures of it. It doesn't do it justice.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, yeah, so when I saw that same one in February 1979, that's the one that I went to see. And we were also in cattle country. And so, yeah, once the that a Terminator hit us, and then the whole sky lit up, the sky goes dark, and then you get the corona flare out. All the cattle that were around us just kind of got up, and, you know, they were like, oh, okay, what do we do? You know, it's nighttime, I guess, where do we go? You could just tell that there was just this confusion that's going on. And I think to the bucket list, too, I would also add an aurora borealis, or either Northern Lights and Southern Lights, or another things that are just natural phenomena
absolutely.
To witness.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Jim and Hayward a chance to join in. Jim, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. How you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Well, this is I'm going to share something a little bit about tornadoes, that question that somebody had just had a little bit ago about how far things can go in a tornado. I work for a propane company, and in this most recent tornado that we had near Kadot, we lost a propane tank that was a 1,000-gallon tank, fully loaded. Wow. That thing's around 5,000 pounds.
Wow.
Wow.
And we found it a mile and a half from where it originally started. So,
wow.
Holy
can
mackerel.
You imagine that thing tumbling by you?
That's
so did it crack and then the methane get out? Or that propane get out?
It actually did. It broke the valve, and it did leak out eventually, yeah. So
yeah, I would imagine the valve.
It was empty.
Yeah,
but wow. Full when it started.
Wow,
wow.
That's amazing.
Thanks,
and then
Jim.
Back to the Twister movie, right? Yeah, let's put the belt on and tie ourselves down.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Oh boy, some more photos. I've got to mention. Take a look here. We've got from Marilyn. She says a rainbow around the sun in Quito, Ecuador.
So that is a halo. So the difference between a rainbow and a halo is in a rainbow, the sun is always at your back because it involves a reflection off the raindrop. This is when you get a circle around the sun when you're looking at the sun. It's caused by ice crystals, and as the light diffracts through it and bends, but there's no reflection, and that gives you the bright wing. And you can even see some color in it as well because the different colors bend different amounts.
And so that's a really cool photo. And here's
there's a double
rainbow.
That's
kind of a double, yeah.
Double rainbow that Randy Ort sent us a photo of that. That was just yesterday in Bayview.
Wow.
So that's the one that our earlier caller was, I'm sure,
talking about.
So those are great, great photos. Max in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Max.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Yes, I had a question. I served in the Navy, and I was sailing through the Straits of Malacca, which is near Singapore, and when we got to the Straits, we had three water spouts dancing around the ship, and I wanted to know if those are similar to a tornado, and do they have similar characteristics, and do you see those out in the ocean or the Great Lakes and areas like that?
Hmm. Yeah, they're similar, but they're more similar in ferocity to dust devils or leaf devils that you might see in the fall. And those particular disturbances, at least if you see them in a city or urban area, are usually a function of the wind kind of rotating around the corners of buildings or something and then picking up debris. Water spouts are much more ferocious than those, but they're not in quite as ferocious as tornadoes. So I think people have told me you can sail a boat through one and not really experience too much damage if you pick the right one.
Yeah. But we're not recommending.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't put it on a recommendation list, but there are some that are probably as strong as among the weaker tornadoes, EF0 or EF1 tornadoes.
Yeah, and they are scary nonetheless. I've seen a water spout in Key West. In fact, the same time period, I saw that circular rainbow doing an experiment down there. And, man, I haven't seen a tornado, but I was scared enough from the water spout.
I've not seen either, but and if I had on my tour of those phenomena, I'd start with the water spout. I'd feel safer seeing that.
Yeah,
but I've not seen one.
Did the water spouts hit your ship you were in?
It did not. I was actually on a carrier, and so I felt very safe.
Yeah, that's not going to do much to a carrier.
And they were pretty big, and they were dancing around the ship, and it was very impressive. I just didn't know how powerful or big they do get. So.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Here's an interesting photo. Take a close look at this one on Facebook from Jill. She says, 1 week after the tornado that hit Chautauqua, Wisconsin, a young local pilot, 17-year-old young man, was killed in a tragic plane crash. This sign appeared over the town the very next day, Thursday, May 25th. It had no arc to it and no corresponding sundog on either side. It was a beautiful sight.
Yeah, it's actually beautiful. If you're online, you should go look at this photo.
Yeah.
You can really see the separation of the colors. Yeah. It's, again, caused by diffraction of ice crystals. So a lot of people call this, because it's not a ring at all. A lot of people call this fire on ice. So you're getting
like
that firing thing, but we know that it's generated by ice crystals, so that's where they kind of play
so
those words.
So it's kind of like a parallel to the ground.
Yeah.
Instead of, it's really...
Yeah,
really,
and it has to do with the structure of the cloud, which is why it looks that way.
Mm.
But it's very much like the crystals you put in your window. Except you have thousands of them, they can generate that color.
Peter in Appleton, hi.
Hi. Can you tell me why high and low pressure systems spin in opposite directions?
Yeah, and it depends on the scale of them. So the scale of storms that are, going to affect 5 or 6 or 8 states at once, the kind that we get winter storms from, or, major rain events or something like that in the fall and the spring, those kinds of low-pressure systems will have a circulation around them that's counterclockwise, and their counterparts, the high-pressure regions, are a flow that's clockwise. In both cases, highs and lows, there is what's known as a pressure gradient force directed from the highest pressure toward the lowest pressure. So it's directed inwards towards regions of low pressure, and it's directed outwards from regions of high pressure towards the periphery. And then balancing that, the flow is close to balanced in our troposphere. Balancing that is a force that results from the rotation of the Earth, and that's the Coriolis force. And so it's going to point in exactly the opposite direction as the pressure gradient force in either case. But the interesting thing is the Coriolis force always acts exactly to the right at right angles to any moving object in the northern hemisphere. So if the Coriolis force is pointing to the right in a certain case, then the wind is going to have to be flowing to the south. And if it's pointing to the left, or the other way around, if it's pointing to the left, the wind has to be flowing to the south. If it's pointing to the right, the wind has to be flowing to the north. And if you put it high and a low next to each other, and you figure out where the pressure gradient force will be pointing from high to low, you can figure out the winds have to turn in different directions around both of them because of the rotation of the Earth.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Janet in Wheaton, Janet, do you have a quick question?
Yeah, hi. I'm calling from Wheatland, Wisconsin. So Wheatland's near New Munster, just south of Burlington, north of Twin Lakes. Nice to hear these guys. They could be goys, I don't know.
We're guys.
These guys from the Northeast. I'm from Fairfield, Connecticut originally.
Oh, is that right?
So the accents sound really good to me. Wondering if you can comment on the bizarre tornado that we had traveling southeast on January 7th, 2007. It totally bypassed my husband's and my tree nursery, traveled in a diagonal direction, went right behind the school, jumped the main road, and then landed again in the housing area. The completely pulverized neighborhoods. My son and my husband were out in the fields for the farmers, picking up everything from dolls to fenders to
whatever. And we've got just a few seconds to comment on that.
Yeah, and we had another January storm like in 2012 or something.
Yeah,
right?
There was a Milwaukee tornado.
So we've had tornadoes every month except for February in Wisconsin. And it's just, I mean, they're more common in the summertime and in June because we get the conditions John was talking about earlier with warm, moist air down below and drier air above.
Yeah, but our storms can be forced a little more strongly in the wintertime. So if you get close to those right thermodynamic conditions and really strong force, you can still get them. That might have been what happened.
Yeah. Guys, we're out of time. Thank you so much. And we'll see you the last Monday of next month.
All right.
There we go. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, they'll be back next month, and we'll do this all over again. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.